On this week's 51%, we look at an aspect of pay equity, meet a woman who turned her love for nut butter into a business, hear from an activist about her work to help ill minors, and we are introduced to a Nigerian pop star who struggles with hanging on to her roots.
I'm afraid I might be transitioning away from sounds that are that ethnic, and that bothers me.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. President Obama, in his final State of the Union speech January 12th, mentioned a few items in need of continuing attention.
And I will keep pushing for progress on the work that I believe still needs to be done. Fixing a broken immigration system. Protecting our kids from gun violence. Equal pay for equal work. Paid leave. Raising the minimum wage. All these things still matter to hardworking families. They're still the right thing to do. And I won't let up until they get done.
There it was, right in the middle.
Equal pay for equal work.
It's a topic high on the list of several lawmakers at the federal, state, and local levels. It's also on the minds of many others. And for one take on pay equity, I've gone back to Linda Rossetti, an author and managing director of Golden Seeds, LLC, an angel capital network that works with emerging female-led entrepreneurial businesses. I previously spoke with her about her book, Women and Transition, Reinventing Work and Life, and now bring forth her thoughts on pay equity. I asked her how a woman is to negotiate for a salary without knowing what her male counterpart is earning, and never mind that likely he is earning more by virtue of gender.
Let me give you a very practical recommendation, right? As you know, look, I ran HR and administration for a Fortune 500 company, right? And I was kind of just a guest in that role because I had spent my career in technology, right? So I kind of had the great good fortune of seeing an awful lot of things from the ground floor. And for anyone who's in that position, a very tactical recommendation I would say is ask for de-identified information. And what I mean by that is you ask for averages, no names, but averages in aggregate of people at your level. So if you're a director, you know, in a company, you say, look, I'd really like to have access to information of what the average director makes in this company, and then I'd like you to split it for me by male and female. And asking for information from human resources or whatever organization within the company, it might be finance that has access to the information, can be incredibly empowering, right? It first of all can tell you, some of the best companies offer it. I believe Deloitte offers it. There are many employers who already offer information like that. But the biggest opportunity for you is to begin to see if somebody says, oh, Allison, I think you're a 90% performer. Like you're a top performer. But then when they give you information and you see that you're only on 40% of the bell curve, you know, 40% of the people are below you, but 60% are above you, you can say, geez, that doesn't really hold water for me. Now let's talk about why and how we can close that gap. Right. So I guess my recommendation would be, first of all, see if your organization would respond to information requests. A lot of companies find that's an uncomfortable place. And my response to that, or my coach for somebody who's asking that, would be to say, look, I'm not asking about individual salary information at all. I want aggregate. Right? Give it to me, average it. Give me the whole bucket. If you've got 27 employees who are at that level, okay, so give me the average of 27. And if you're in a very small company where, you know, if they gave you an average, it would be very clear that it's John's salary versus Jane's, think about other levels of information that you could ask for that would be non-revealing but nonetheless instructive for you. Look, it's going to depend on the tone and culture of the company. Many of the best companies are already trying to do that, right? They're starting to do that. I can tell you from an executive perspective, and anyone who has a public board, that information is being generated on a very aggregate basis for the board, right? Because the board is asking, okay, give me the, or they should be, I hope because of, you know, all all the governing bodies, be it Sarbanes-Oxley or other governance, you know, requirements that boards are asking their leadership of companies to provide that data. And, you know, any company that's using any kind of salary tools, and many companies today are, you can get that information in a query, in a quick query. Ultimately, it's very significant to ask for, right? Provisioning of data, you know, is only one step, right? Ultimately, somebody has to have the confidence to ask, right? To say, I'm sorry, manager, I don't think I'm at the right level. Can you help me see how to get there? And coaching, you know, an employee, if I was sitting here with an employee and I had the good fortune of talking to them 5 minutes before they were going into their manager, I would say, look, instead of making the conversation individual, like it's about me, talk about it almost in a de-identified way to say, for an employee at this level to perform at X salary, what would they have to do? And then use your individual information to talk about gaps to that, right? So really, really asking the manager to engage in a conversation about what could you be doing at that level, and then say, okay, well, where do you perceive my gaps? And if the gaps are zero, which oftentimes they are, oh, there are no gaps, you're doing great, then okay, tell me what the max salary is for that job. And if you're not at the max salary and yet there's no gaps between your performance and what the best is doing in that role, then you've got a problem, right? And then you escalate that problem.
Interesting. But I'm also hearing it that they do not have to hand over this information.
Well, you know, need to. I guess that suggests, is there a law? I don't think there's a law that says that they have to. But I don't know that there, you know, I don't know the answer to that.
Because it seems to me that if we have all this information, or people even know to ask for it, you know, if we know that, in general, we're making 70 cents on the dollar, it boggles my mind. Wouldn't there be a revolution if we suddenly saw some of this data, if it were broken into gender and we don't know who it is? I mean, that we could maybe make more waves.
So let me give you, right, so I gave you a very tactical to-do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me bring it up one more level, right, and say, why isn't it happening? My fundamental belief after observing kind of a whole workforce as the head of HR is that we underinvest in the development of managers. An inexperienced manager is going to evaluate you based upon how close you are to me, right? And so you're not me, and if for whatever reason on simple basis you're not me, if I'm a man and you're a woman, then, you know, you're never going to be at the standard I'm going to be at, and I'm always going to penalize you there, right? So companies really have to invest in training managers so they get away from what might be an instinctual way to review, meaning you're not me, and get them to very objective measures of managing or evaluating performance, because performance evaluation is what drives pay. Right, so then ultimately we have to go from evaluating performance to making sure then managers know how to allocate raises based on performance, right? And so all of that is very, very important. And I think when you think at a macro level what's going on, companies, you know, have a lot of priorities. And managers move jobs all the time. And ultimately, I think we, on balance, underinvest in some of those developmental things that factor into compensation decisions, right? So it's a complex problem. It isn't like, you know, I was saying earlier, it isn't like a flick the switch, oh, boom, we're done with that. There's really a fair amount that goes into that decision about, okay, how am I going to pay you, or how am I going to offer you a raise? You know, and we have to be aware that if there is a multi-prong activity that happens there, you know, we have to make investments on all of those in order to kind of move the needle. And I think that we get distracted as businesses, right? We have a bad quarter, or we go through a recession, and it's all hands on deck to try to maintain profitability. And we let some of those developmental investments go onto the wayside. I've been in business since the mid-80s, right? And in 1980, we were teaching people about this thing called targeted selection, and it was how to hire somebody who doesn't look like you, right? It's really to try to figure out what the job needs and trying to identify those capabilities in a candidate, right? Allison, I'm fascinated now that, you know, nearly 30 years later, we're still talking about that. If more women bring up their voices instead of what they should or could do, you know, based on some standard that isn't them, I think those voices are going to be louder, and they're going to really agitate much more, not only for pay equity, but all sorts of policies and programs that are going to allow them to be included in the economic arena, right? Because a lot of women disengage or downcycle because they can't possibly do it all, right? And so you have this dynamic that, you know, gee, women are underemployed because they take crummy jobs because they get little flexibility because the bigger jobs don't allow them to have flexibility, right? And so I think in focusing on transition, it brings up women's voices. And my belief is that once that happens, those voices will be so loud that they will really cajole people to say, enough is enough. Like, I can't believe we have an FMLA, Family and Medical Leave Act, right? Wonderful. Somebody can take up to 12 weeks if they need to address a family issue. The reality is it's unpaid.
Right.
So I don't know how many women can do that, right? So I hope transition contributes to this and really gets us down the field. Programs and policies have to happen in parallel to women bringing their voices up much stronger.
That was Linda Rossetti, author of Women and Transition, Reinventing Work and Life. The 51% interview with her about this book was in show number 1373. A woman near Albany, New York, has turned her passion for health and nutrition into a business. As 51%'s Dave Lucas reports, she planted the seed of an idea and sprouted something called Nutsez.
Each January, most of us make resolutions, but only a small percentage of people actually stick to them, which many times involve a change to a healthier lifestyle. You might get some inspiration from this story involving a local woman and her love of almond butter. Amanda Zesima is the founder of a company based in Cohoes called Nutsez.
My business started pretty much because I was doing a bodybuilding competition, and the diet wasn't working with the way my body was working. So I'm diabetic, and I've been diabetic for 23 years. So my body needs more healthy fats to help stabilize my blood sugar. So instead of dropping out fats, we dropped out carbs, kept fats high to help keep my blood sugars more stable. So I was eating a lot of healthy fats. I was getting really bored with the plain almond butters that were in the stores, and it was hard to find ones that had no salts, no sugars, no added oils, just plain. So I started making them on my own.
Who knew nut butter could become a cottage industry? That was just the beginning. Zesima began to tinker with different flavorings, mixtures of spices and protein powders that wouldn't negatively impact nutritional value.
Not all nut butters are the healthiest, but almond butter is one of the biggest bangs for your buck. Our bodies all need fat to stabilize, to live, to go through its proper functions, and almond butter qualifies for that. For myself, I need 70 grams of healthy fats a day just to maintain and stay the same. So almond butter is a really quick, easy way to do that. You take a spoonful of it. It has a lot of biotin in it, potassium, vitamin C, D, A. There's a bunch of different other benefits in it, as well as just being a fat. The biggest thing about that people get scared with fats is that if I eat fat, I'm going to get fat. It's not like that with healthy fats. Our bodies need it to function.
When she realized how much of an impact the nut butters were making on her own health, Zesima decided to spread the news by making her own gourmet almond butter.
So all of my clients would bring in the new batch, the new flavor I made that day, and it was all just for fun. I just wanted to share it with them, see what they thought. I wanted them to experience it, and I just wanted to share. And they just kept on coming back and asking me for it and realizing that there's nothing else on the shelf in the market that's similar to what I make. I just decided to make a career out of it.
Zesima has a grueling schedule. Besides her own time-consuming bodybuilding routine and daily appointments as a personal trainer, she works long hours packaging and promoting her nut butters. Zesima buys 500 pounds of almonds every 2 or 3 weeks, a pound of almonds per jar. She just recently hired a helper to assist with labeling and other aspects of production.
So I'll go in there during the day, make huge batches, and I leave them in the fridge to cool, because if you jar them while they're hot, they'll melt the jars. So I go in there, do my thing, make all the butter, put it in the fridge, cool it, and then my helper comes in later on that day, and she jars it all up for me now. So that's been a huge help. I used to come to the gym, train people, go back there at night to finish jarring what I had so that I can make new ones in the morning.
Zesima recommends making sandwiches with nut butter and sprouted breads instead of snacking on donuts or bagels. She says healthy fats lessen your hunger pangs.
you're eating a healthy food with vitamins, a bunch of different minerals in it. I have my almond butters have the added protein in it. So you're getting a really packed, full meal on the go, easy. So a sprouted bread, something like the Ezekiel bread, it's also low glycemic, no processed foods in it, no salts, no sugars, just all the good stuff that our body needs.
Almonds have a new partner. Sesame has a surprise. Anyone for Nutawana?
Within the year, I've partnered with a medical marijuana company in Connecticut. So we make the healthiest edibles in the country that anybody could have. Our philosophy behind what we make is that food packs a nutritional healing power. And if we eat the right things that go towards what our body needs in our different disorders or issues or symptoms, we can make ourselves feel better by using food.
For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
Musician Mary Jane Mazzolo has taken up the cause of trying to secure compensation for terminally ill minors in South Africa. The 31-year-old human rights activist has helped file a lawsuit against the mining industry on behalf of thousands of workers with lung diseases. Miners allege their employers were negligent. These miners believe they are ill because of prolonged exposure to excessive levels of toxins while working in the gold mines. We get this report from DW correspondent Hannah Frankenfeld.
Blues musician and human rights activist Mary Jane Mazzolo of the renowned Treatment Action Campaign, TAC, is once again leading a demonstration in the streets of Johannesburg calling for compensation of terminally ill miners. She played a key role in the lawsuit against the mining industry brought by 25,000 mine workers with lung diseases. For Mary Jane, protests like this one are an important part of her life, just like the Treatment Action Campaign.
We have an enormous amount of experience around social justice issues and health-related issues within South Africa.
In no time, she and her fellow activists have transformed the basement of a nearby church into an exhibition space using self-made posters and portraits of sick mine workers. It is hard work, the musician says.
Hey, I'm so exhausted. It's been such a long day.
Still, Mary Jane is unrelenting in her effort to support tens of thousands of miners who fell ill working in South Africa's famous gold mines. The miners want to take on their former employers in a class action suit. But before they can do this, a court has to agree to hear the case in this format. It is now up to the High Court in Johannesburg to decide whether the class action can go ahead. This is the first tangible result of years of activism and litigation by Richard Spohr of Richard Spohr Attorneys, who took on the gold miners' case. Mary Jane Mazzolo is thrilled to meet the miners' lawyer.
I'm MJ, by the way, from the Treatment Action Campaign.
Yeah, Richard Spohr, hi.
Oh, you're like my hero right now, representing these miners.
Richard Spohr represents 30,000 sick miners in this court case. He feels that civil society activists like Mary Jane perform a vital role in the miners' struggle for justice.
We need civil society to kind of stand up, mobilize them as a political force, and speak on their behalf.
These men have given their lives, literally, to the success of the economy and to the many profits that are being enjoyed by many of these mining companies. And today they're dying a slow and painful death, and it's not fair.
Mary Jane's activism, which she says she probably picked up from her father, is also rooted in the country's oppressive history.
My dad, who passed away 2 years ago, was a revolutionary songwriter, and he sang and protested against the injustices, against apartheid. And this is exactly what we are doing right here.
Must be out of your mind. Dum, dum, dum. Why the hell you wanna come over here? Dum, dum, dum.
That was Hannah Frankenfeld reporting for Deutsche Welle. In her native Nigeria, Cynthia Diehi is a pop singer who celebrates her culture through her music. She's still relatively unknown, and holding on to her Nigerian sound in the face of Hollywood producers has proven difficult. Maya Williams reports.
She was born Cynthia Diehi, but her stage name is CY. flashes of red streak long black braids that fall down her back. In LA, she can easily blend into an eclectic crowd. But back home in Nigeria, her music plays on the radio, and she performs in front of massive audiences. I was wondering the other day the way that I could. She's trying to cross over in the United States while keeping what she calls her Nigerian sound.
My music is supposed to be me, it's supposed to be my thing, and part of who I am is a Nigerian. And if I'm not able to do that in my music, then, you know, it's like, what's the point?
But when she came to LA 2 years ago, the first music producer she worked with didn't quite get it.
Usually, the way production works in my experience is you bring your creativity, I bring mine, and we try to merge them. But this guy wouldn't leave room for my creativity. So he wouldn't leave room for those things that I identify myself with.
Like elaborate, almost tribal background vocals, layers of indigenous drums, elements of her authentic Nigerian sound.
So yeah, basically he took all that away.
This is the song that producer created. I bet your mama didn't raise no lazy girl.
It's become a disgrace, oh lazy girl. That just wasn't gonna fly with me, because you're not gonna give me like a Beyonce style beat, because Beyonce is awesome, I love her, but that's not the kind of artist I am. I feel like I'm on the outside looking in.
To compare, One Day is what CY calls her most ethnic sounding song. It reminds her of her grandmother's wisdom. You may bring me down,
but I will not stay there. So it's just a bunch of Nigerian proverbs that talk about karma. The first line was monkey, like actual monkey. Go market, Inogu come back. That means, literally means, a monkey will go to the market and it won't return. One day, monkey go market, Inogu come back.
One day, dog we no be here, what go talk true. But channeling her roots hasn't always come second nature for CY.
But I've heard from my friends back home that I tend to sound too foreign when I sing. From the Nigerian context, I tend to sound a bit too Western.
She performs her newest song for me. It's called Falling Into You. After 2 years struggling to hold on to her cultural sound, CY's noticed her grip is loosening.
I'm afraid I might be transitioning away from sounds that are that ethnic, and that bothers me.
And this song seems to signal that departure. But she plans to add in traditional Nigerian accents. Still, she says its message transcends cultures. Can't hold my head up in front of you. I
look away to hide the truth. Yeah. Those were the first lines that came to me, like, can't hold my head up in front of you. So the girl is torn between revealing her feelings to her friend and ruining their friendship. So most of the emotions are universal in my music. It's just expressing them. I try to make it cultural.
CY from Nigeria. Let's do this!
CY's not exactly sure where she'll end up in this musical journey between her homeland and Hollywood, but she's very sure of one thing. She's got to sing. That's all I want.
That was Maya Williams reporting for Bending Borders in a series called Between Homelands, Hope, Fear, and Longing in America. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1384.